You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new WPR project seeks to build understanding and appreciation by exposing us to the sacred traditions and music of other cultures. We'll find out more. First, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement was unveiled this week as the new three-way deal to replace NAFTA. President Trump says it's a big win for the United States, especially in sectors like farming and manufacturing. There's another industry with a big stake in the deal that's not getting as much attention, and that's technology. Heather Timmons is the White House correspondent for Quartz. She recently wrote about what the new deal means for tech companies like Facebook and Google. Heather, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Well, good. Well, I will admit I hadn't really thought about this. You know, I know there aren't tariffs on my Facebook posts if somebody in Canada reads them, but there are key points in this new agreement between the three countries that affect technology. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The deal, what the deal does is it essentially replicates language that is already in the U.S. Communications Decency Act. And this is language that was written into it in 1996, back when the internet was sort of, you know, this bold new world and these companies that were starting up were tiny startups without much money. And what it did is it protected them from libel. It protected them from being responsible for the content that was on their sites. So if they're distributing, you know, if one of their users is putting something up that says something bad about someone else, you can't go and sue Facebook. And as these companies got bigger and bigger and bigger, this law didn't change at all. So that's still how it is. You know, there's some lawsuits right now against Alex Jones, a conspiracy theorist. Those lawsuits are going right after his company. None of them go after Facebook or Twitter or YouTube or any of the ways that he spread the lies that he spread, because this law protects them. And so now that it's written into NAFTA, this law will also, you know, these companies will also be protected in Canada and Mexico for this kind of liability.
So previously, without this exemption, it might be that if somebody had posted something libelous on Facebook in the United States, potentially somebody in Canada could sue both the person who spread the libel and Facebook for hosting it. Would that have been a possibility?
I think it would depend on exactly what they were posting and who it affected. I think it would have to affect someone in Canada for them to be able to sue for that. But what it does is it gives them sort of blanket protection. Another example for is that Amazon will, in some cases, no longer be liable for counterfeit products. It won't be liable for counterfeit products that are on its site that are put on by a third party. So if there's a third party that's putting something on there and it's actually not really a Gucci bag, let's say, or whatever it is, you need to go after the third party as a consumer. And Amazon can say, you know, because I'm a publisher and I'm an intermediary here, I don't actually have responsibility for this.
Did we see the Googles and Amazons and Facebooks of the world lobbying during the process of negotiation of this new NAFTA? Some people are calling it the U.S. MCA.
Yeah, they have spent just a ridiculous amount of money down here in Washington in the past 18 months. And it has been on all different kinds of things. And it's sort of hard to tell exactly what they spend their money on. They have to declare what they're talking about when the senators file and they say, you know, I sat down and I talked with a lobbyist and they came from here and this is what we talked about. So you can see little bits and pieces of where they have talked about NAFTA. They have spent billions and billions. That has been, you know, partially for this, and also because there's a big push, especially after the 2016 election, to try to regulate these companies more. You know, everybody has a sense that they've grown really big and really powerful, and they are responsible for the distribution of so much of our news, and this is where we get so much of our news from, and there is really no, you know, regulator that looks at them.
So these companies had an interest in saying, we don't want to be regulated by Washington in particular. We also don't want to find ourselves in a situation where an international trade agreement subjects us to new kinds of regulation.
Exactly. And, you know, you can see there's very country-specific regulation that affects them. Germany is such a good example because it is illegal in Germany, for example, to say that the Holocaust never happened. And so these companies, Twitter, Facebook, spend money to make sure that if somebody puts something like that up, they take it down and maybe they punish the user or they, you know, do some sort of strike against them. So they will, you know, country by country, they will spend money and they will devote resources to making sure they're following the laws of those countries. And so when you get a big pan deal like this that covers all of North America, that makes it easier for them.
Talking to Heather Timmons, White House correspondent for Quartz, about how the new deal, the one that replaces NAFTA, this United States-Mexico-Canada agreement, affects big technology companies. And Heather, this key issue that you wrote about was this libel thing where a tech company couldn't be sued for someone else posting something on their site that's libelous. But there are some exceptions in liability for things that these companies host. Can you talk about that? FOSTA was something I hadn't heard of before.
Yeah, and this is a really hard-fought piece of legislation, and it's sort of, it is one of these things that it makes sense if you think about it on either side. You can see both sides of it, but what the legislation does do is give these companies liability for anything that's promoting prostitution or sex trafficking on their sites. And so they have to spend money again and go and look through and see what their users are putting up and take down stuff and punish users if they're doing that. And so it's a very specific, it is prostitution related, sex trafficking related. The internet companies say that they think that is way too broad. Once they consider it a slippery slope, once you start holding them responsible for some things on their site, then the next step is more censorship.
Right. The analogy, I guess, would be you wouldn't charge the phone company if their phone lines were used for purposes of sexual solicitation, right? Is that kind of the analogy that's made here in defense of the tech companies?
Yeah, that's a good analogy. You know, these guys like to say we're not publishers. We're not responsible for what's published on our platform. We're just sort of distributors. And so, yes, if you think of it like a phone line, you know, if you're running a sex chat line, it's not AT&T's fault necessarily.
But ultimately, their arguments fall short. What were some of the arguments from the government and others who favored that kind of restriction?
Well, I think that their biggest argument really was, and there were the people, the Congress people that put this bill through, you know, had some supporters and some family members who had relatives that had been victimized or even killed by sex traffickers. So there was some really powerful testimony of parents getting up and saying, "This is what happened to my child," and it all happened through, you know, the back pages or some other website which was enabled by these companies. And had there not been this internet, had the internet not spread this information around, this may have never happened to my child. And so that was, you know, what they were able to do. And it can come, you know, it's very different than sort of a newspaper with a couple pages on the back when you've got something that comes right into your home and it's on your phone and, you know, your kids can see it and use it all the time.
So that's in U.S. law, that liability for, say, Facebook, if they hosted this kind of information. How did that all play out in the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement?
You know, they put a specific carve-out in this for the U.S. laws, SESTA and FOSTA, they're called, so that they will still stand in the U.S. Canada does not have a similar law, although prostitution is not legal there. In Mexico, I think it's about 13 of the states out of the 30-something states, prostitution is legal. So I don't, you know, it's hard to say how this all sort of shakes out and what I think that, you know, these countries can opt into, you know, and write, they'll obviously be writing their own laws about internet prostitution, what is and isn't legal. So this doesn't really dictate, you know, what they need to do there.
As you mentioned, NAFTA came about in the 90s when the internet was just sort of this vague notion of what it was going to be. NAFTA didn't really do much on any of these kind of tech issues, did it?
Yeah. No, the Section 230, which is the U.S. law, that was written in the 1990s. NAFTA itself had very little to do with the internet. And so, you know, it is a good thing. I mean, NAFTA needed to be updated. It really did need to happen. And it is good that it has happened.
So we've talked a lot about this NAFTA renegotiation here, and I'll say we've talked a lot about dairy and metals and cars and things like that. This is the first time we've talked about these technology regulations. Did you get a sense in the negotiations that these were kind of an afterthought for negotiators after all that other stuff, the tangible stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I think for a lot of people, they were focused on the cheese, as you said, you know, or the steel
well, here in
or
Wisconsin,
the autos.
Sure.
Well, yeah, and, you know, and Trump was focused on the cheese. You know, the dairy was really, really, really front of mind for him, even though the negotiation that they finally did work out, you know, they moved the needle just a tiny, tiny percentage. So, yeah, this was probably not front of mind at all, which is why when you have an industry like the tech industry that's spending billions of dollars on lobbying, they wind up with, you know, in this case, this is sort of exactly what they wanted. There wasn't much pushback either way, and it wasn't really front of mind for anyone.
And as we wrap up, Heather, this isn't quite a done deal yet. Congress has to weigh in on this. Legislatures in Canada and Mexico, too. Is there any, do you expect any kind of 11th hour bargaining or lobbying on these issues we're talking about?
You know, we heard recently after we put this story out from one of the attorneys that's been suing Facebook for allowing employers to discriminate because of the way their ad tools, you know, work. And so you might hear some people saying this needs to be, you know, a little bit less broad. It's hard to figure out what kind of traction that might get. I think that, you know, at this point, when we've gone back and forth negotiating NAFTA negotiations for so long, people in Congress are sort of at the point where they're like, phew, thank goodness this is all done, you know, and we've still got this whole China trade war going on. And I don't expect this to get a huge amount of traction now if someone wants to push back.
Heather, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That's Heather Timmons, White House correspondent for Quartz. She was with us to talk about how big technology did under this new replacement for NAFTA, the United States-Mexico-Canada agreement. You may know Jonathan Overby as the host of WPR's The Road to Higher Ground World Music Program that airs on Saturdays from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. on our news and classical music network. He's created a new project now called the Odyssey Series Live. The series centers on sacred world music. Each event is open to the public. It's designed to increase understanding of a variety of cultural, spiritual, sacred, and communal traditions. You can get more info on the Higher Ground show page at wpr.org/programs/higherground. Ideas Network producer Judith Sears Poisson spoke with Jonathan Overby about the project.
Where did the idea for the Odyssey Series Live come from?
Well, it's an outgrowth out of the Saturday night broadcast celebrating world music. And several years ago, I had the idea that perhaps there's something more important than just the music. Perhaps there's a pathway to better understanding the diverse groups that live here in Wisconsin. So I determined that it was music that could help us better understand Wisconsinites and the diverse communities and groups that reside right here in the Badgerland.
As you've been looking into this, what have you found? How music and faith and world perspectives and beliefs fit together?
Well, instead of using the word faith, I use the word spiritual. Hmm. And in many cases, I use the word sacred, because in some traditions, what is sacred is not something typically associated with either faith or liturgy or some setting in which people gather, like many of the major religions in the world. And so I look at sacredness as, for example, when people gather together to have conversation every day and it becomes part of their ritual. It becomes part of celebrating that community. And they tell stories and they sing songs and they relate to each other and they talk about how their husbands are off fishing and they've been gone far too long and they wish they were home and perhaps their kids are bad and they're washing clothes. And it becomes something they do every single day. And that experience draws them together as a community. And so that, in my view, is very sacred because it's tradition, it's edifying, it celebrates that group and that community.
What I love about what you just said is that often when we use the word sacred or hear it, we think lofty, we think almost unapproachable. And what you just described is really the fabric of the most common shared human experiences.
Well, it's the commonalities and the unique embrace of traditions, and it can be both. There's nothing unsacred about higher deities. In this case, what I'm proposing and what my research has discovered, some of it flawed, but much of it very consistent, and it says to me, the communities that I visited throughout the world, that the deepest held sentiments about groups all around the globe are found in their sacred traditions, spiritual, communal, ceremonial, And of course, those things that are rooted in what we term traditional liturgies. And that is much more encompassing, much more celebratory, and I think it's edifying. And I think if we look at those elements of how people embrace tradition, we'll find there's a pathway to better understanding each other. And I think that's what music does. It allows us to hear, to grow our ears, and to learn more about diverse communities here in Wisconsin and the world.
We all grow up with a particular angle of culture that we are steeped in from birth. What traditions, what musical expressions of the sacred have you encountered in Wisconsin or around the globe that have really touched you that are not something that came from your own background and your own experience?
Well, that's one of the challenges, is that to get out of my own way was an issue, to set aside my biased interpretations from the beginning, to look at how other people perceive the world, life, each other, those who are different. That's part of the challenge, and I think that's what's important about understanding people who are different, is to see them not as the stranger, but as the friend who is welcomed, like so many traditions suggest that followers, practitioners should do. In some cases, there are traditions that say you must welcome the stranger and do it in a way that's wholesome and edifying. And so that is the challenge for all of us, to get beyond our own expressions, our own traditions, how we grew up, whether it was in a traditional church or something that people see as the other, and embrace them all in the spirit of good community.
Of course, it's wonderful when we can really, like you said, do research, delve into backgrounds and different concepts and expressions than we might know ourselves personally. But is there also something to be said for when you encounter something that is different and new to you, just kind of letting it wash over you and kind of feeling it as something new and exciting?
Well, it's okay not to feel it. It's okay not to want to endorse it. What is not okay is to ignore it or to marginalize it. So when you listen to a piece of music, you may say, it's not my favorite style. But to have some understanding of what that particular piece of music or the genre of music represents is very, very important. Because what people tend not to understand, they marginalize. And what they marginalize, they often hate. And what they hate, they turn their back on. And in some cases, we found tragically, they kill. So the mission in part of the series is to get beyond the exclusionary ideas that are polarizing, nationalism, racism, gender discrimination, xenophobia, transphobia, and religious intolerance, to say that if we want to contribute to humanity worldwide, we must set aside our hatred. We must work to try to better our communities and our nations by struggling to do away with the disease of hatred, and to seek a binding cure. And I think that cure, in part, can be found in sacred traditions associated with music.
We're talking with Jonathan Overby. He's host of WPR's The Road to Higher Ground World Music Program that airs on Saturday evenings from 7 to 11 p.m. on WPR's News and Classical Music Network. And he's with us right now to share information about a new project. It's called the Odyssey Series Live. And what are some of the specific topics that you plan to delve into through this series? Because these are huge global concepts that we're talking about. How are you bringing those to life, to people?
Well, they're not huge for the community that is being celebrated. It may be huge to those who've decided that this is the limit of what they're going to define as sacred. However, there's an opportunity when you explore to find the commonalities, to look at things that exist in many of the major religions and most of the religions around the world: hospitality, love, respect for the stranger, meaning the person who is different. And these elements and many, many more exist in most of the world's religious traditions. But I also say it must be something that is rooted in good. It must be something good rather than an expression that tears down other people. That is not part of the focus of the series. The series is going to look at women in music and how the role of women have helped to change the landscape of music making, looking at traditions that were secular moving into sacred traditions. We're also going to have some Hindustani classical music, which is very, very old, and how that particular tradition in Hinduism and other religions helped to define humanity around the globe.
And what do you hope people who are able to interact with the Odyssey series live will take from this into their own lives and into their own sacred traditions?
Hope is an extremely important thing to consider. But at the root, it is about embracing. So if you want and have a desire to learn about others, then you must meet those people where they are at in many cases, and not assume that they can look different, but they must act like you and I act. That is not inclusion. That is not a celebration for others. And so part of it is to grow our ears, to grow our eyes and our sense of what represents good. In many traditions, there's such a polarizing effect of if you don't believe what we believe, then you're something very, very bad. And I think that's dangerous. I think it's disrespectful. And I think we can do much better in our effort to celebrate people around the globe.
So what are the upcoming Odyssey Series Live topics, and how can people find out about them?
Well, they can find out about them on the Road to Higher Ground page at Wisconsin Public Radio. But the second in the series is about women in music, women in Eastern Europe, who historically have created songs that were popular songs, secular songs, and they morphed into sacred pieces. Mm. So from secular to sacred, and in some cases, those songs that became sacred went back to being secular. And we're going to have a presentation about that particular area of music, and particularly focusing on women who helped to create the world of music.
So people can find out about upcoming events on the Higher Ground page.
They certainly can.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Ideas Network Director Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with Jonathan Overby about a new project that he created, the Odyssey Series Live. You can get more info about the series on the Higher Ground show page at WPR.org. The FBI has completed their further investigation of Judge Brett Kavanaugh as GOP senators push to bring his nomination to the full Senate for confirmation, likely as soon as Saturday for a final vote. Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater and director of their Center for Political Science and Public Policy Research. She joins us now to bring us up to speed. Susan, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, it seems like the big argument right now between Democrats and Republicans is over the scope of the FBI investigation, how many people they talked to, what they looked into. Can you talk about that?
Sure. It's interesting because when you listen to Republican senators comment on what they've seen in the report, they seem to be pretty much in lockstep that there's nothing in the report that suggests that any of the allegations have been corroborated. On the other hand, Democrats have been consistently saying very little about what's in the report and more so what's not in the report. And that speaks to your question.
Yeah, who haven't they talked to that we know of so far that Democrats say, wait, they should be part of this investigation?
Well, there's a couple of different groups. I would say the first would be Julie Swetnick, who was a third woman who made accusations against Judge Kavanaugh, and she was not part of the investigation. And so what the investigators looked at were the accusations by Deborah Ramirez and by Christine Blasey Ford. So there's that third woman. And then secondarily, a lot of people have come forward who knew Brett Kavanaugh at the time of the allegations, who have contacted the FBI themselves and asked about being interviewed, and they were not interviewed. And then finally, Christine Blasey Ford herself was not spoken to by the FBI, nor Brett Kavanaugh, from what we understand.
Initially, the deadline for this investigation was set for tomorrow. Now we have this report. This is, I think, an unusual situation, Susan. It's done. There's a secured room. Senators are filing in and out and either looking at it or having portions of it read to them. This is an unusual bit of Senate work.
Yeah, it's interesting because apparently the report was delivered to the White House and then the Senate sometime in the middle of the night last night. The White House issued a statement at, I think, 2:29 a.m. this morning, indicating information about the report. And then, as you said, first thing this morning, you had senators, on the hour. The Republicans had the first hour, and then Democrats, and I believe it's gone on throughout the day, where this one copy is in a secured room and individuals can go in and read it, as you said.
We'll talk about kind of who's on the fence or hypothetically on the fence here, but I want to talk about the process a little. What we're hearing is a final vote on Saturday, a preliminary vote, a cloture vote tomorrow. What is cloture in the Senate?
So cloture means essentially cutting off the debate so that they can move forward on having the final deliberations and then the final vote. And both the cloture vote, which is scheduled to happen tomorrow, and then the final vote, which we're hearing maybe Saturday, require just a simple majority.
Now we have a 51-49 Republican majority in the Senate. Republicans can win a tie on this, a 50-50 vote with Vice President Pence breaking that tie. There's no filibuster on this stuff anymore, so a simple majority can do it. Everybody's watching some Democrats, especially in red states, who might vote for, and some Republicans who might theoretically vote against. Who are you watching most closely?
I think right now I'm watching Lisa Murkowski most closely on the Republican side, and Joe Manchin on the Democratic side. The people who we had been focusing on most closely on the Republican side were Susan Collins, Jeff Flake, and Lisa Murkowski. And I've seen statements from both Susan Collins and Jeff Flake indicating that they appeared satisfied with what they saw in the report. And on the Democratic side, Heidi Heitkamp is a Democratic senator from North Dakota who is in it's a deeply red state. And then Joe Manchin is a Democratic senator from West Virginia, another deeply red state. And Heidi Heitkamp this afternoon came out and said she was going to vote no. So from what I understand, we still don't know about Manchin and Murkowski.
Talking to Susan Johnson from UW-Whitewater with the latest on the confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh after this week of FBI, some additional investigation into claims of sexual assault. Want to get into some of the wider issues and other stories going on related to this. On Tuesday of this week at a rally in Mississippi, President Trump mocked Christine Blasey Ford, the kind of the main and first accuser. Here's a listen to part of that.
36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Can you talk, Susan, about the response to that rally, including from Republican senators?
The response was the response that we've come to expect, I would say, when President Trump does something that is quite out of the ordinary and viewed by many as unacceptable. And so we heard Lindsey Graham say that was, not helpful. I'm not sure the exact words he used. Those three senators that I mentioned earlier, Jeff Flake, Lisa Murkowski, Susan Collins, both very strongly came out and said that this was not appropriate. Someone on the Republican side used the word appalling. And so there was pretty strong reaction. But again, that's generally what we get from Republican elected officials.
Nobody has said, because of that, we're going to change our vote. There's no at least overt statement that changes anything.
No, and I haven't heard anything to that effect. I've just heard, a few people condemn him, or several people condemn him for what they thought was not being helpful in the process and not necessarily being something that they would sign on to.
I want to get into some of the possible political fallout from all of this. There are these midterm elections going on. Democrats and a lot of polling had advantages and enthusiasm in generic congressional ballots. We've seen some Senate race polling now showing Republicans doing better than they had previously. Some Republicans are arguing, hey, all of this battle over Kavanaugh is going to rally Republican voters in a way that they weren't. It's going to get them out of any kind of lethargy they had. What are your thoughts on how this could all affect midterm elections?
I think that people are focusing in quite closely on a very recent poll that came out that, as you mentioned, made the case that Republican enthusiasm was now at a level that was fairly equal to Democratic enthusiasm, while it hadn't been at that level maybe a month ago or so. And so I think that has some Democrats concerned. I read an interesting piece this afternoon that suggested that perhaps whatever the outcome of the confirmation process is may then serve to energize one party or the other. So, for example, as it's looking, it appears that Judge Kavanaugh will be confirmed. And the thinking might be that then a reaction to that may be to re-energize the Democrats or amp that up a little bit. But, you know, we don't know anything. The election is, it's getting close, you know, but a lot can happen in 5 weeks. And so as of right now, though, there's been a resurgence of Republican energy, I would say.
And maybe in short run and a longer term issue is women and how they're reacting to the day-to-day, what's going on with Judge Kavanaugh, what we're hearing from President Trump. Is this something that might expand an already existing gender gap between the parties?
It could. I mean, if you think back to the confirmation hearings with Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, that was what kicked off the first year of the woman, the 1992 election. And we're already in a period where over the past year, year and a half, and some would date it back even to the 2016 election, the idea of women being energized and mobilized. And I would think that some of what's going on right now with the Kavanaugh nomination and some of the reaction, let's say, to even some of the shift in the tone by people. Now, originally, they were very respectful of Dr. Ford and her allegations toward Judge Kavanaugh, and we've seen that kind of shift, and I think that that might have an effect on how women are perceiving certain candidates and might super energize them for November.
We're getting the latest on the Kavanaugh nomination and investigation. Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What should Wisconsin's two senators do? They're pretty much committed one way or the other on this, but what would you like to see them do when it comes time to vote tomorrow and Saturday on this nomination? What do you think of this FBI investigation happening? Was it more than was needed? Was it not enough? Should Brett Kavanaugh be the next U.S. Supreme Court justice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We're taking a look at where the nomination battle over Brett Kavanaugh is right now. Susan Johnson is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Whitewater. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think of that dramatic day of testimony from Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Brett Kavanaugh back on Thursday? What do you think of the way the Senate is handling this confirmation? Should Brett Kavanaugh be the next Supreme Court Justice of the United States? You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan, before we go to our callers, Supreme Court justices, it's always been a big deal, I think, in American politics, but it seems like in the last 20, 30 years, it's this huge issue that people are voting on now. Do you see that?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think back to the 2016 presidential election, we heard a lot from the Republican side, particularly in regard to the fact that there would be an open seat to be filled because the Senate would not consider Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, to replace Justice Scalia. So that was a very politically charged issue, and people were talking about it. And I think moving forward, we will see it even more so.
We heard from some listeners on Facebook. Brandy writes, this isn't about criminality at this point. It's about his honesty and demeanor. And some people have said, based on Brett Kavanaugh's especially emotional opening to his statement last Thursday, that he didn't have a judicial temperament. Some of his Republican defenders said, well, if he's a falsely accused person, you can understand that kind of passion. Is this an argument that is worth making? Does somebody have a, quote, judicial temperament?
I think that if you're asking whether or not it's an argument, you know, worth making in terms of swaying someone at this point, I don't know that it is going to make a difference. I mean, to be perfectly honest, but I think that big picture, stepping back, the idea of a certain Supreme Court justices having a a certain temperament is something that I think people have come to expect. I think that also we hold our Supreme Court justices up as being somewhat, or not even somewhat, but we expect them to be nonpartisan. And when they're in their confirmation hearings, they often don't want to speak to political issues, and they don't want to speak to specific public policy issues because they don't want to be seen in that light. But what we saw from Judge Kavanaugh last week were statements that I think many people took to be quite overtly political, and that struck a lot of people as not very Supreme Court justice-like.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Judy is with us in Appleton. Judy, hello.
Hello. I totally think that Kavanaugh should not be on. I watched the full 9 hours of that thing. I couldn't go get away from it. And what I took away from it was the lady was scared to death, and she was asked a question, yes or no. She said yes or no. He was asked questions. He skirted around them and then totally got upset. And you can't have somebody doing that on the Supreme Court, and that's a forever thing. They should make that so that is not a forever appointment. That's my thing on it. But if they push him through, which they're going to, because I know they probably will, it's going to have a countrywide fallout on that.
Got it. Judy, thanks a lot for the call. So Judy was swayed by Christine Blasey Ford's testimony and swayed against Brett Kavanaugh. Susan, do you think the testimony changed a lot of people's minds, or did they just affirm what people came in with? I know it's like a bit of political psychology here, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think that it was interesting with the full day of hearings, because after she was done, we heard so many people come forward and say that they found her to be quite credible in what she had to say. Many Republicans came forward. Many senators said that she seemed quite credible. And then after Judge Kavanaugh, and he had his afternoon session, then you had some of those same people coming forward and then showing their support for Judge Kavanaugh. So, but I mean, honestly, in this highly charged partisan environment that we're in, I think a lot of people went in with a certain idea about what to expect. And I don't know how many minds were changed.
We heard from Rick on Facebook. Rick wrote, the Salem witch trials are alive and well in the U.S., only now the witches are running the show. Careers and families can be destroyed with mere accusations. Be careful what and who you support. Democrats, you could be next. So is this process for Brett Kavanaugh going to poison future Supreme Court nominations, maybe when Democrats are making those nominations?
I don't know. What Rick is speaking about certainly has been getting a lot of attention. The president, one of the clips, another clip from that Mississippi rally had the president speaking about situations of false accusations, and he's personalized this in a way as well, because there's been several allegations against President Trump in regard to sexual harassment and sexual assault prior to him becoming president. So, I mean, I think that it's fitting into the narrative of being concerned about false accusations. But what the data show are that then, while there are false accusations, the number of false accusations are very, very small. Will they increase now? I don't know.
Go back to our callers. Keenan is on the line in Milwaukee. Keenan, hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What do you think?
So I wanted to comment on, I think this whole thing, it seems as though to me that before even there was a hearing, and it seems before even this has become like a national issue, it seems to me as though both sides, Democrats and Republicans, really already had made up their minds. And I've seen so many people comment on these issues, and it just seems so, it doesn't seem as though the trial has, that there's been the ability for us to figure out what exactly happened. And it seems as though every question and every conclusion from both sides is made entirely based on their either believing that something happened, or their belief that the accusations are completely uncredible.
Keenan, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, it's very possible, Susan, that the vote that happens, if it does happen on Saturday, will be very similar to what might have happened 2 weeks ago or before any of these accusations came out. Maybe one or two Democratic senators might vote against that might have voted for all this and not much changes.
I think that Judge Kavanaugh likely would have gotten about 54 or 55 votes if we had not had the allegations that came out after the initial hearings and testimony were over. I think that you would have had a number of red state Democrats who would have supported him, thinking strategically and politically about the November election. And so I think that while it would have been close, it wouldn't have been razor thin like it is right now.
Thanks, Keenan, for calling. We'll go now to John in Duluth, Minnesota. John, hi.
Hi, and we don't have much time. I had two things I was going to mention. When I heard the hearing of just Kavanaugh, I was impressed with his knowledge, and even though I vote Democratic most of the time, I would have been fine with his confirmation. After I saw the hearing with Ford and Kavanaugh, I couldn't support a guy like that. So it changed my mind about him. Secondly, in terms of Trump's comments at that rally, I was at a party where a girl was gang raped. And I don't know exactly what year it was. I think I was 16, but I'm not sure. I remember one person, a friend of mine, was at the party. I don't remember who else was at the party. I don't know how I got there or how I got home, but I do remember that incident, and I remember her leaving and the guys calling her a slut and all that. Those details I remember.
John, thanks a lot. We don't have a lot of time. Thanks for sharing that story. And Susan, I want to talk about that, the impact this could have apart from this nomination. A lot of people are talking about sexual assault. We've seen this Twitter trend, why I didn't report. This is maybe changing something on a wider level, even outside of politics in the United States.
I think so. And I think, again, to get back to the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill hearings that raised awareness about workplace sexual harassment, I think that this is going to raise awareness of sexual assault and sexual harassment that happens amongst young people in this country.
We'll leave it there for now, Susan, and watch for what happens over the next couple of days. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Susan Johnson is an associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater and director of the Center there for Political Science and Public Policy Research. She joined us to talk about the latest developments in the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination and this FBI investigation that is wrapped up. U.S. senators, probably as we speak, reviewing that information. By the way, the U.S. Senate is scheduled to hold a cloture vote tomorrow. That's that preliminary vote. That's tomorrow, Friday, to close debate on the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court. You can hear that broadcast live here on the Ideas Network. It is scheduled to start at 9 tomorrow morning. Coming up tomorrow afternoon on Central Time, we'll look at the U.S. decision to opt out of a long-term treaty with Iran amid a wider breakdown of relations over the last few months. The author of a new book on Ebola tells us how the epidemic spread, how to prevent it in the future, and what the disease tells us about public health and how we deal with outbreaks. And it's October. We'll get a taste of some Oktoberfest beers. A beer expert joins the show with some great recommendations. That and more tomorrow on Central Time.